We were together in the previous talk. You will remember that we spoke as a continuation of an earlier talk, which was on the meeting of the Lord, the presentation, and we spoke about his mother above all, and by extension about mothers in general. On the occasion of that talk, in our last one, we extended the subject, so to speak, to the family, because the mother is almost the pillar of the family. And there we said how the mother must conduct herself in order to succeed, how the family ought to be in relation to the will of God, and why, in a certain way, so many fail in their effort to build a family, so that we have so many thousands, not to say millions, of divorces of every kind. That talk the other day did not finish as it should have. And tonight, if I may, let me add a few more things, so to speak, around this same subject. What was left over that I had in mind to say is the opinions of certain holy people. If we want to build a blessed family, what we must keep in mind. For example, St. Ignatius the God-bearer says the following, and I will put it in simple words, every man and woman who marries should be united with the blessing of the Church. You know how many so-called married couples are not truly married at all, because they were not blessed, they never heard the words, and the two shall become one flesh, spoken over them by any minister of God entrusted with joining them as one. They remain two separate pieces, even if they live together for years. And there are many such people who live together unlawfully. They do not have the blessing of the Church. These do not belong among married couples. You cannot say, this is my husband, and this is my wife. When she dared, if you remember, the woman who was once the Samaritan woman and is now Saint Fotini, to say, I have no husband, when our Christ said to her, go call your husband to come here, she said, I have no husband. And our Lord answered, you have spoken truly. Truly you say that you have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. It is true, he says. You have lived with five up to now as your husband, and you have a sixth now as your husband, and he is not your husband. So here he says, all who marry, men and women, should be united with the blessing of the Church, because the children they bring forth will bear the consequences afterward. The point is that their bonds should be according to the Lord, and not according to fleshly desire alone. So says St. Ignatius the God-bearer. This often happens when we tear down our own house and take from the demolished ruins and go to join with another to build a new house out of the rubble. It will not be new if it is built from the ruins. They may say they have no permission, no divorce. One excuse after another, but you cannot come under God's blessing in this way. God does not grant you his blessing. Others, likewise, have personal interests that keep them from being crowned in holy matrimony. I unfortunately know a very elderly couple who have now lived about 40 years unwed in the Church, and she will not be crowned in marriage because she is the daughter of a general and does not want to lose the pension, so that she can keep drawing the pension from her father. I do not know how much she receives. But 40 years she has been unwed, and you understand now how she will appear before the eyes of God. And if she were some poor little thing, I would say, well, perhaps, let the poor woman not be left out on the street. That is how she reasons. But she is not even poor anyway. Another holy father says, if the young come to be married with bodies pure and undefiled, for this indeed is the very purpose the wedding crowns are meant to serve, that they crown people who struggled and remained pure, who remained virgins, and for the struggle they waged to preserve their virginity, he crowns them. Crown them with glory and honor. The others, rather, should be crowned with dishonor, not with glory and honor. Therefore, if those who come to enter holy matrimony do so with bodies pure and undefiled, then the fear of God will be greater, their union more honorable, and their children filled with blessing. The other unions are the offspring of sin. The children themselves are not the offspring of sin, but of blessing. And take heed, the children are not at fault for anything. And your responsibility is great before God, O man. And he holds this same opinion and says, but if someone begins, when he is younger, to be dissolute, to throw his life away and to regard fornication as natural. As some say, then there is the danger that he will return to that dissoluteness. He remembers the old haunts, and when he later marries, he goes seeking again the disorder and the profligacy. These are the words of the divine John Chrysostom. Perhaps you may see it as far-fetched, as we were saying, very strict, that a person should be pure until his marriage. So much has slipped out of its proper place, and that is why these things seem to us hard to achieve. St. Ignatius the God-bearer says that the young man should marry from 14 years of age before he falls into fornication and corruption. Secondly, the most holy Theotokos is the classic example. From when is a woman in a position to bear children? From the day she has her monthly cycle, there is no reason these would be given to her for her to shed her blood if the purpose were not childbearing. Yet we wait until we become tycoons, like Onassis, before we marry. The daughter waits, even though she may have secured enough to support two households for life. She will not deign to take some good young man who is poor. No, she must take one with a higher salary and a higher position. And now the casual flings begin and the dragging on, and you reach 39, never quite 40. And then she marries and waits to have a child, and they can't bring it out, not even by cesarean. Why? Because we have departed from the natural laws that God has set for us. The people used to say either marry young or take up the monastic life young. That was wisdom drawn from experience, and an answer to the question I addressed earlier. If the child does not want that when he grows up, then, as the saying goes, either marry young or become a monk young. Today we ourselves have created a society, a way of life, in which people place so many nooses around their own necks that no one can loosen them. Not even the sword of Alexander the Great can cut them. For have we not fashioned a Gordian knot around our lives today? We keep asking when someone will finally be ready. He is not yet established. She is not yet established. She is too young. She is too old. Leave her be. Leave her be. We insist that she must first learn everything else, all the finer points, and only then marry. Leave her be. She already has the instinct within her. God has given it to her. The cat knows how to handle her kittens. And as for the woman who will read the book too, leave her be. God knows. Do not enter with your own reasoning into the matters of God, for you will do harm. And you see that despite the prosperity, despite the means, despite the civilization, despite the civilization, despite there is misery and 100% failure in the matter of the family, because the basic conditions are not taken into account. So it is considered, I admit, somewhat harsh. Yet know that if you want to have the blessing of God and beyond that for the church to take you up, you saw how she takes the wedding crowns. She takes up the crowns and gives them to be guarded, God says. Have you paid attention to the prayers, or do you only look to see if the bridesmaid is pretty and what gifts were given? Is that what you watch? Have you ever listened to the prayers? She takes them up because she tells him, take these and guard them in there. What is there to take when these are defiled from the very outset and unclean, and ought not even to be presented in the church for the sake of those people who have left nothing sacred or holy? And set aside that notion that favors the man, that the man may be unchaste while the woman must be chaste. Seriously, from where do you draw that right, man? From where? Do you not have a virginal membrane yourself? Do you not have a virginity to keep, just as the woman does? We will have to give an account before God on the day of judgment for taking something without his blessing. Beasts have no virginity, no hymen, neither do animals, birds, or fish. Human beings do. So if God has set limits and boundaries, that means he will also demand an account. That is how I understand it. It is beautiful, but we do not know its worth. When the bride enters the church, led by the hand, whether by her father or her brother or the mother of some prominent person, they chant in there first the hymn of St. Constantine concerning the relationship of mother and son, the Troparion, and then, In the moment when everyone offers to shower them with rose petals, with rice and so on, at the hour when the priest takes them and calls also upon the prophet Isaiah to rejoice over the virginity of the virgin, while she has been dishonored from the cradle. Isaiah danced for the virgin. Why should he dance? What business has I in the midst of it? Isaiah is the very one who spoke concerning the virgin. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel. That is to say, even this Isaiah we mock. Come here, you who rejoice there over the virgin, rejoice over this virgin too, and convey to us that joy which you felt when you beheld the virgin who would give birth. At the very moment when we have no virgin, neither man nor woman, the virginity of our most holy Theotokos is the testimony. And if you mothers want to have the mother, the most holy Theotokos, as your protector, see to it, in whatever you have done up to now, that your children learn. The words, "Behold the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto me according to thy word," how they are interpreted. In a single moment she raised her hands and said, "Behold the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto me according to thy word. Let it be done. I surrender myself. Whatever you will upon me, within me," and so forth. That is the reason. That is why he spoke to her sooner. The patristic literature has spoken beautifully on this subject. Let me convey to you a few of the opinions that take up the position of our most holy Theotokos regarding this purity of virginity. St. Andrew of Crete says, for example, "Behold, I stand ready, I am ready, I stand ready, nothing hinders me. My soul is willing, my womb fruitful, for it is untouched and blessed in obedience. My soul is willing, and my whole being is untouched, preserved and ready for the Creator. Who is your maker, woman? You know God, and by extension, your husband. Have you kept yourself pure for your husband? I repeat this question to you. Behold, I stand ready, and nothing hinders me. My soul is willing, my womb is fruitful, for I am untouched, kept for my Maker alone. For my Maker I have remained untouched. For him, behold the handmaid of the Lord, obedient and ready to submit, fit for service, ready to receive. Let it be to me according to your word." St. Gregory of Nyssa, speaking of the same event, says, "Behold the handmaid of the Lord, let it be to me according to your word. As a handmaid I await the sovereign command. I am ready to submit to your slightest gesture. Like clay I lie in the potter's hands, and with a single touch you can fashion me into whatever you desire. Do with me as you will and with full authority. Let your will be accomplished in me, as you desire in your love for mankind. Work within me the miracle of this wondrous conception. Let it be to me according to your word." St. Theophylact of Bulgaria says, "Behold the handmaid of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word. I am like a blank panel for an icon," he says, "a whiteboard ready to be painted. Let the painter paint whatever he wills upon it. Let the Lord do whatever he wills. I am a whiteboard, paint upon me whatever you will." This is how a woman should be when she enters into marriage. St. Athanasius the Great says, "Behold the handmaid of the Lord. I am a panel upon which an image is being painted. Let the artist paint whatever he wishes. Let the Lord of all do whatever he wills." This is precisely where we fail to be consistent. And we ourselves know what we have been through, what is happening to our children, and what is happening within society. Can such a family ever prosper and bear what we might call blessed fruit? It is not possible. Another father from the early centuries, Tertullian, those of you who read will know of him and will have heard his name, says the following, or rather, he extols this marriage, a blessed marriage, entered into with purity, chastity, and reverence. He says, "Where shall we find words fitting enough to describe the marriage joined together by the church?" That is, where will we find the tears and the weeping and the words to speak about the marriage I mentioned earlier, the one that has no blessing of the church, but where too will we find the words? if the couple has come rightly to the church to sing the praises of that marriage. A true union must be confirmed by self-offering, sealed by the blessing of the church, witnessed by the angels, with not a single angel able to speak against it, and ratified by God. In other words, the union must be spotless, so to speak, then it is truly blessed. And I would tell you something more. Lower down, one writer says that the true marriages are contracted in heaven. That is, God is the one who unites people, and here below the confirmation takes place through their joining together. God is written in his records, this man for this woman for this man, and so on. The marriage is contracted in heaven. Don't you remember the day before yesterday when I told you of two incidents, one in the book of Tobit and the other mentioned in the book of Proverbs? In both of these cases, it says that God is the one who gives the wife to the husband and the husband to the wife. Of course, we do not ask him because we do not believe that God watches over a person if that person entrusts himself to him as he should. And as someone else says, if a person took care to enter into holy matrimony, then as a rule, he would also go on to build a holy family. Of course, some members of the family may stray, but generally speaking, a family with blessed and firm foundations will be different. Otherwise, it is like covering a tooth with gold when its root has already decayed, or the tooth is loose. That is how it is. Even if you cover it with gold, what good does it do? Since the root is damaged, is rotten, that is what happens to many who come to the communion of marriage. Now, a few more thoughts on the subject of the family. From the Christian family, says one father, the feet may be removed, but not the heart. Whereas when there is no Christian family, a person turns his eyes elsewhere and leaves. He does not even want to hear of it, nor to pass by there again. People often leave because they do not find outside what can give rest to their soul as well. They remember the home, they remember the hearth, they remember the elder. Even if they lived more poorly, even if they lived more obscurely, they feel themselves back there, and they daydream, and they long for it within. Because, as I said earlier, all of civilization cannot make a person happy, because civilization does not heal the root. It builds on the outside, it adorns the outside. Take a mule, take a little donkey, and load it with gold. What will its worth be? None. Is that not so? Does it gain any worth because the donkey was loaded with gold? No, it never stops being a little donkey. Let us not imagine that because we have managed nowadays to cook in a pressure cooker, and the braid of onions we used to hang over the pan is gone, we have achieved anything great. How easily you can take that pot and bring it down on your wife's head today and strike her over the head with it a couple of times. You do not do such a thing. Happiness is not there. Happiness is inward. Happiness is spiritual. That is why one writer calls them patches. The proposals of this world love, good behavior, have mutual understanding, have love, very fine. Let them have Christ. These things you tell a man to have love are patches. It will hold for one evening because he was embarrassed before you, and the next day he will start the same again because he has no Christ within him. He has nothing at the foundation. If love does not have as its principle the salvation of the soul, but only of the body, how shall we have a better time? And how shall we enjoy one another? Then it meets with no success at all. The matter of husband and wife. Paul, in Romans, I see, at 14:15, writes that Christ died for souls. With us, the effort is for bodies. The family has an eternal destiny, and it affects eternity. The persons have eternal worth, inasmuch as they are souls for whom Christ died. And if Christ has value both where he now is and in eternity, then so too do the souls of the family, which have a relationship with Christ. That is what he means to say. Would that the families, he says, might understand this age above all, the age of today's clamor and destruction, and turn toward eternity. Because when a person is laid hold of by Christ, he at once begins to think differently. He sees all things as refuse. He sees his destiny. He sees his mistakes. He sees how far he has fallen. He sees that he is nothing, that tomorrow he departs, that the day may not even dawn for him. He begins to reflect deeply, and at once he finds a way to step onto the road. Furthermore, the family that makes its home a heaven, let it be certain that it will make heaven its home. The family that makes its home a heaven, let it be certain that it will make heaven its home. Whatever family from today lives as they live in heaven, its home will be in heaven tomorrow. And they with it, that is what I want to say. It will win heaven. What goes on in heaven today? What is it that marks heaven out in comparison with earth? First and foremost, there must be obedience and respect for one another. Is there disobedience in heaven? There is no disobedience in heaven. Is there respect in heaven or is there not? There is respect in heaven. These are the things that are lacking here. If a person is to make his home a heaven from this very day, there must be mutual understanding and consideration. Bear one another's burdens. When the wife is tired, let the husband support her. When the husband is tired, let the wife support him. When the husband is tired and raises his voice, let the wife lower hers. If you respond to the other person in kind, the home will come crashing down. What is needed is a mutual understanding and a mutual completing of one another. For the most part, this does not happen. If the husband shouts Alpha, the wife shouts Omega. Whereas if the husband were to shout Omega, the wife ought to shout Alpha, so that they may meet somewhere in the middle. But for a person to do this, to create peace, love, and mutual support in the family, and to make the home into a church, these necessary conditions must be present. Yet they are not. People did not look for these qualities when considering holy matrimony. They looked at other things, social standing, money, physical beauty, the flesh pleasures, mannerisms, and so on. They neglected the essential question, the question of the soul, whether they were united in soul, and whether they met beneath the blessing of Golgotha. Because holy matrimony means Golgotha. It means the cross. Once the cup of honey has passed, then Golgotha appears most clearly. And that is where courage and strength are needed, where a person must weigh his responsibilities before he puts his neck into the yoke with another. Because to be a spouse means to be bound together with someone else inside a single yoke. We enter a yoke, and you should know, when one ox pulls, the other has to show what it is made of. You know about these things, the ox teams in the village, the pairs of oxen. And he goes on and says, family life is the method of God. It is also for the upbringing of children. The child will not receive its formation for this passing life and for eternity, either in colleges nor outside in book learning and so on. Because all of that builds the head. It does not build the heart. The person who has not grasped the heart of the matter stops at knowledge. He sends the child off to become a real human being, and instead it becomes a beast. Because by human being the world means someone educated, someone who can throw the hoe out of his hands, whose hand no longer grows calluses, and so on. That the world calls a human being. But a human being, if he does not carry the qualities of a human being, if he is not reasonable enough to want to understand the things of his own soul, if he grants little to the worth of others, if he does not place himself at the service of others, to that degree he is not called a human being. He only bears the name. And so family life is God's method for the raising of children. It is the mother above all, with the father in a secondary role, who will cultivate and shape the human being. All the great men confess that they owe their success to their mothers above all, because, I repeat, the father is the carrier, the guest in the house. He learns everything last. He is only there to carry the load. It is the mother who knows the secrets, who reads even the sealed letters. She is able to read the soul of the child, whether boy or girl, not simply to hand it over to a nanny, not simply to hand it to some teacher, over there to teach it English, German, and so on. You will turn the child into a beast, and then you will weep bitter tears, both in this present age and in the age to come. It is within a Christian home that a true family is formed and a child is truly brought up. I would also like to say this. A person can endure anything out in the world, especially a man, when there is compassion and mutual understanding at home. He needs to find rest within. When a man goes out into the arena to work or to gain certain skills so that he can earn a living tomorrow, it is as though he falls onto a playing field and the players begin to strike him the way they strike the ball. One moment they send him out for a corner, the next they put him out of bounds, and then they foul him. That is what the arena of life outside the home is like. A woman does not know these things, especially a Greek woman, apart from those who have gone out into the world and work. In any case, the kingdom of the woman is not in the world, it is in the home. It is a defeat that the woman has gone out. Satan led her out. God could have arranged matters, but we do not ask him. We set our own reasoning above his, and in this too we have failed. So, if the woman remained like a queen and created warmth and comfort in the home, she could absorb all her husband's weariness and all the difficulties he had encountered, even if he had been wounded by them. God has given us sleep. You sleep for 10 minutes and feel rested. Your headache goes away, though all the aspirin in the world could do nothing for it. You get up with renewed strength, and so on. How did this happen? It happened through a mystery, through a gift that God has given to man. Now imagine having living human beings there, your wife, your children, and so on, who have been properly formed and prepared to welcome you. Even if you come home like a lion, they will soothe you. You will calm down as you enter a blessed atmosphere, one made ready for the man who has been struggling out in the world and suffering. They should say, "Take care, father may be angry. He may come home in a state. We do not know what has happened to him," and act accordingly. But that does not happen. Today the mother is doing her nails and staring at that demon box, that idiot box over there. And many times the husband comes home and simply sets out his food to eat. Can such a thing ever be considered a married couple, a family able to raise children properly? Can they build a family that can salt the rottenness that exists today and the breakdown of society? It is not possible, as you can understand. The builder of family life is love. When we say love, your mind always runs to Eros, always to the cup of honey, but this love, love that stands above sacrifice, is something else. True love, not satanic, not self-serving, not carnal. Loves like those carried many up to the Acropolis, and they fell to their ruin. There is another love. The love that is sacrifice is not there. True love cannot exist in the home. I once read somewhere, and it seems I have written it down in one of my books. There was a sick person in a home, a young man, and a neighbor woman had a grapevine. The vine ripened its first bunch of grapes. She thought it good to cut this bunch and give it to that boy, the neighbor's son who was ill. And indeed, she took it to him at a moment when no one else was there. She said, "I brought you this little bunch of grapes. Thank you very much, Mrs. So-and-so," and so on. He put it there on a little plate and did not eat it. Later, at noon, his mother came home from work and saw the little bunch of grapes there. The young man said, "Mother, they brought me 2 little bunches of grapes. I ate one and saved the other for you. Thank you very much, my child, but you should eat this one too." "No, mother, I ate mine. You eat the other one." "Let us save it for your father." The ascension. Taking responsibility, as I said earlier, the man must be the harbor where his wife finds refuge from the storms of life, and because he is usually the one out in front, the one who bears the brunt of the waves, he is the one who needs greater care. And you know, when the head is kept well, the body is sustained. If the head is not kept well, the body is not sustained. That kind of love does not exist today. We hear women open their mouths this wide, but against whom? Against whom, tell me? You insult your husband. He is a fool. He is this. He is that. But you are insulting your own person. You are insulting yourself. Where would you be without him? You cannot be understood apart from him, unless he is merely your lover, your adulterous partner. But if he is your husband, the man with whom you were joined beneath the wedding crowns, then he is your own person, he is you yourself, and you are yourself only together with him. Apart from him, you cannot be understood. God united you and made you one flesh. So whom are you insulting? He is your strong half, and at every moment you are his tender half. It is your own face you are attacking. The people of old used to say it, the simple folk who never learned their letters, but who had the fear of God in them. If I spit upward, I spit in my own face. If I spit downward, I spit on my own beard. That is how it is. Whom are you going to spit on yourself, of course? You were so unworthy, and this is the sort of man you went and chose. Who can you go and tell your troubles to? Who? Did anyone put a gun to your head? Did they crown you in marriage by force? What was done to you? And only now you've discovered it. Ask God honestly, did God send this man to you? And if it really was God who sent him, then again, show patient endurance. You have a reward for it, and there is a reason behind it. But you didn't do that. You arranged it all on your own, and that is why you're left with consequences instead of fruit. If we wanted to reflect a little, the exceptions in these matters are countless. We need to grasp things from the root because we keep grabbing at the branches. It is like this, it is like that, yes. But why is it like this? We have to find out why it is like this. Even the doctor sits with you for 2 hours to take your history. You say to me, doctor, why are you asking what happened back in 1910? Just answer me what I am asking you. From your history, he work out why you are suffering today. Nowadays, you run off to the madhouse, to the psychiatrist here, because we don't want the spiritual fathers anymore. So the psychiatrist hears your confession, and you bring out pen and paper, what I did with this one, what I did with that one, how many children I killed, this, and you confess there. You pour out your whole filth. You hand your whole self over to a man who has no power to do a thing for you. Nothing beyond handing you a fistful of pills. And those pills can do anything for you. Matters of the soul are not healed with drugs. They need spiritual care. They need Saint Gerasimos. They need Saint Nectarios. They need these things, fasting, vigil, prayer. So why confess all that to him? And why won't you go and confess to the priest who actually has the power to help you and set you free? Everyone wants to learn your history, to have you confess your sins to them, to see why your soul is worn out, what it is suffering from, what has passed over it, which sin passed over it and brought it down to this condition, to this state. Do you understand? So if a person won't search himself in depth and say, my God, yes, it is true, you're right, I made all of this myself, I never asked you, I imagined I'd just landed in this world by chance, that I was here by the whim of my father and mother, and so I thought I could do as I pleased, and I tangled everything up. Please, take it from me. And again he takes it. Again he takes it. There are other matters, matters that no human reasoning can solve, no human love, no sacrifice. Repentance solves them. Metanoia and the honest acknowledgement of it. There has never been a single person who turned to Christ and said, I have sinned, my Christ, yes. You are right. And did not find mercy. God has countless ways. Cast all your care upon him. And who is it that does these things, continuing along these thoughts? Our family circle is a royal setting. The Christian family circle is a royal setting, provided, of course, that Christ reigns there. So often we peer out through the shutter to see who is knocking. And if the person doesn't pay us the honor we expect, measured by our own logic and our own yardstick, we don't open the door to him. Or if we do open, we send him up the back service stairs. We imagine that this way we can pick and build a household of standing, a blessed home, happy and full of joy, and so on. Nothing of the sort. As long as Christ isn't there, there is no love in practice, there is nothing. The setting is royal when there are Christian people in a house. You see the blessing, you see the faces speaking, even with their mouths closed, the faces speak, the little ones, the husband or wife, the grandfather. But what is missing is this Christ, who changes souls, and through them changes the faces too. That is why you walk into some houses and feel as though you've walked into a madhouse. You don't know where to take shelter, and no matter how many smiles are scattered around, no matter how politely they try to cover over what is boiling underneath, it is no use to the cunning and to the good alike. It becomes clear that nothing there is standing. There is no real family. Here is another definition along the same line of thought. A Christian family is also one in which Christ is honored as a member of the family circle. Let me say it again. Listen. A Christian family, again, is one in which Christ is honored as a member of the family circle. When you go into a house and Christ isn't there as a person, as a member of the family circle, it isn't a matter of proving. I'm a Christian because I have an icon, and I've even put an electric lamp in front of it day and night so he won't complain to me when the oil lamp happens to go out. Or because I light a candle, because I go to church. It is seeing Christ in the house as a person, that there is a person present in the home, Christ himself. There are five of you, and you see Christ beside you as well. Because when you see Christ beside you, you'll pray properly, and you'll look at the table to see if it is Wednesday or Friday, what you've set out on it. And when you go to your bed, you'll be aware that Christ sees you as a person, and that in the morning, you'll get up to go to church. If you arrive after the third bell, you may as well not go at all. Christ knows it and sees it. And you young ladies, when you put on men's trousers, look in the mirror and paint your nails, however nice these things may seem. If a person sees Christ as a real person and knows that Christ sees them, they will not do such things. He would not engage in fraud or shady schemes. He would neither do such things nor act on them, speak of them, or put them into practice if he saw Christ. I remember that once, in another talk of ours, I mentioned a man who was involved in schemes and fraud. Whenever he saw that someone was going bankrupt, he would hurry to another man and say, so is going under. This is our chance to take his property off his hands, buy it up, and make something out of it. Come on, you put up the money, and I will profit from it too. And so, one morning, he knocked at the door of an office. Inside was a prominent businessman. Unfortunately, certain people had been given such free access that even a general could not enter. Yet this man could walk straight in because he knew some of their weaknesses. Come, come, he said, before even wishing him good morning. So is going bankrupt. Come on, let's buy up his assets for half their value and so on. This is our chance to make a killing. Strangely, however, Christ was standing at the far end of the office. The man who entered did not see him, but the man inside did, and because he saw Christ standing there, he said, I will not do this. What are you talking about? The other man said. Are you an idiot? But what a sight he was beholding. Such people are brazen in matters like these because their other frauds and schemes have given them free rein. I cannot do it, he told him. Do not pressure me. The other man brazenly hurled abuse at him, even adding a blasphemy, and slammed the door, saying, It will go to someone else, someone who knows how to take advantage of opportunities like this. A haul of stolen clothes and the like, an opportunity, a real windfall. He did not see that there was a guest in the room. And in that degrading moment, he told the man to take them, just as he had taken other things stolen by this friend of his. But once again, in an indirect way, he told him not to take this or that, saying, I cannot, and offering one excuse after another. In any case, the other man insulted and cursed him, and on top of that told him to leave. Once again, the gentleman turned to him and said, You did exactly the right thing. What you earn by the sweat of your brow is what remains with you. This is not yours. You did not earn it by your own sweat. And at the same time, you are helping that man in the shady work he is doing. In both cases, he did not sin, because he could see Christ. We at home do not see Christ. We do not have Christ. The proof is that there is no fasting, and so there is no Christ either. There is no prayer, and so there is no Christ either. neither within us nor outside us. There is no upbringing in the faith, and so there is no Christ. There is no honesty, no morality, no sense of decency, none of these things, and so there is no Christ either. The Christian family, he says, must see Christ as a member of the family. And if it sees him as a member of the family, this carries over into the conversation. It will ask, "What did we do for Christ today, madam? Where is his plate? Why did you not set out Christ's plate today? And Christ has brothers. Why will we not fast on something this week? Give up a little something